practical problems that emerged in R2P itself. You see, the responsibility to protect was going to come under what is known as Chapter 7 of the UN mandate, which would allow use of force. Who decides when the civilians are in threat? When does the international community say, enough people are being killed, now we need a no-fly zone? What is your evidence that civilians are being killed or in threat? This is not an idle question. What is a proportionate response under the R2P mandate?
That's Vijay Prashad, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Vijay Prashad on Responsibility to Protect, a new cover for intervention. Following the mass killings in Rwanda and the international community's failure to act, the UN formulated a new doctrine called Responsibility to Protect, R2P. Its key provision is sovereignty no longer exclusively protects states from foreign interference. Libya is a perfect example of R2P gone haywire. There were hyperbolic reports of atrocities, bloodbaths, and massacres. The U.S. invoked R2P. A U.N. resolution to protect civilians was passed, and its authority almost immediately exceeded. NATO embarked on a heavy bombing campaign. R2P quickly morphed into regime change. Gaddafi, Libya's leader, was assassinated. Hillary Clinton joked, "We came, we saw, he died." Cheers could be heard in the corridors of power in the West. Today, Libya is a broken, devastated country. R2P, if it is to be effective and have credibility, cannot be selectively applied, nor can it be used as a cover for big power intervention. Our guest today is Vijay Prashad. He's professor of international studies at Trinity College in Hartford, Connecticut. He teaches courses in international law and human rights. He's the author of many books, including Arab Spring, Libyan Winter, and The Death of a Nation and the Future of the Arab Revolution. He spoke at Penn State University in University Park, Pennsylvania. And now, Vijay Prashad.
The U.S. war in Afghanistan began on October 7, 2001. 15 years! Let me just make a few comments about that war. Many years ago, before she went into exile in Dortmund, Germany, when I met her, the Afghan communist leader Anahita Ratibzade told me something very interesting. She was quick to rattle off statistics, you know, and you can take these perhaps with a grain of salt, although I caution you not to take it with a grain of salt. Because I remember in Delhi in the late 80s and 90s, seeing the fruit of those statistics come as refugees. What she said was that during the PDPA government, the People's Democratic Republic of Afghanistan's government, during that period, half of the civil servants in Afghanistan were women, 40% of doctors were women, and 70% of teachers were women. That was at the high point of the PDPA rule. At that time, Anahita Ratibzade said that in Afghanistan, the United States government with the Saudis and the Pakistanis started to support people inside the country who represented a different view of humanity. And the man who headed Jamaat-e-Islami's youth wing at the time, Gulbuddin Hekmatyar, and he had made his name before the Americans decided that he was the greatest freedom fighter, by throwing acid in the face of young women studying in Kabul University's engineering faculty. That was the origin of his politics. The reason I remember Anahita Ratibzade today and the conversation I had with her, she died in 2014. The reason I remember this is that 15th anniversary, the Taliban is essentially back in control in Afghanistan, having control over most of the countryside, having control over half the districts in Helmand province, including almost having taken its capital, having twice taken the northern city of Kunduz and having been in control almost of two other provincial capitals. So the Taliban is back in the saddle. And secondly, the government of Mr. Ashraf Ghani has made a peace agreement, a deal with Gulbuddin Hekmatyar. So the road to peace, apparently, after 15 years of American war in Afghanistan, is to bring back Hekmatyar to power. Now, Mr. Hekmatyar, by the way, was raised out of the sewers of his politics in the 1970s, brought to the mainstream by immense funding by the United States. You might have seen Charlie Wilson's war. Charlie Wilson saw people like Hekmatyar, in fact, Hekmatyar himself, as a great hero. After the PDPA was destroyed, meaning the Soviets pulled out, the PDPA lasted for 2 years after the Soviet pullout. After the PDPA was destroyed and the last leader of Afghanistan, Najibullah, was lynched on the streets of Kabul, after this, Hekmatyar and his allies shelled Kabul for 2 years using American munitions. More people died between 94 and 96 in this shelling than had died in the war between 1979 and 1994. So, extraordinarily brutal person with the skills of brutality is now going to masquerade once more as a man of peace. This is indeed what the fruit of 15 years has brought. Remember, this is not the fate of Afghanistan. Remember that in a previous generation, not far from your own, half the civil servants were women. It was a different modus operandi. Anahita herself in 1978 led the move in the government to create a social agenda which included the right of women to divorce, the right of women to have half property of their family, etc. An incredibly expansive social agenda. And the only way to unearth that social agenda and those social forces for the United States, Saudis, and Pakistanis was to ally with the very worst forces who opposed everything that these people stood for. Now, whatever your beliefs about communism might be, or socialism, or social democracy, let's set that aside. The practical choice made by the West, the Saudis, and the Pakistanis was to fully back and therefore give social power to some of, let me just put it bluntly, some of the creepiest social forces in society and allow them to dominate the country. Keep in mind that this is a history that has been produced. It is not the fate of Afghanistan. There is way too much fatalism assigned to Eastern societies, as if this is their cross to bear. They are backward, they are unable to come to modernity, that they have a problem with equal rights for women. Not true at all, indeed, because we know that, again, just a few generations ago, this was the forefront of the agenda of progressive forces in Afghanistan, and they had a very considerable following in Afghan society. I didn't come here to speak about Afghanistan, although I could speak about this for hours, because it deeply frustrates me how our history is so desiccated. We are unwilling to look at that great country and see that it has a really quite a powerful history, a history that is a mirror of histories in South Asia and further out into West Asia. But I came to talk about something else. There is Libya. There are people who live here. In 1974, my father had an odd job. He used to, on behalf of the government of India, sell coal. And he had been to Lebanon and Turkey in the 50s selling coal, and he returned to North Africa to sell coal in these markets. So I went with him in 1974, which was 5 years after Gaddafi had seized power. Libya's main exports were not oil. They were two things at this point. Oil was beginning to develop because it had just come into its own. It may have been already one of the top two, but it was not yet a big deal. They used to export esparto grass, which is used to make paper, and they exported scrap metal. Now, the scrap metal was the detritus of World War II. Because as you drove across the border from El Alamein, a big battle in World War II, to Tobruk. I mean, these are all real places, but they're battlefields. You'd see German half tracks buried in the sand, you know, British tanks, and they would be stripping the metal and selling it in the international market. This was the big thing. But as you entered Libya, there were enormous pictures of Gaddafi. Because until about the late 1970s, for the first 10 years, Gaddafi was an extraordinarily popular man in Libya. In fact, the interesting thing about the overthrow of the king in Libya was that the king was greatly reviled and hated, and Gaddafi's coup took place without a shot being fired. This was the last major Nasserite coup in the region. If the Nasserite coups begin with Gamal Abdel Nasser in 1952, on the other side is the coup in Iraq, where Qasim overthrows the monarchy, you know, and then in this end, in 1969, it's in Libya. Now, these are interesting coups because these were coups conducted by people who were not generals. These were colonels' coups. You know, that's an important thing. They had, their support was in the rank and file of the armies, and they were very much closer in touch with society. So when Gaddafi conducts the coup in 69, it was greatly popular. And in fact, in the early 70s, there were these giant pictures. He was a very attractive looking man. There were giant pictures. People adored him. That was 1974. Let's leave that aside. Let's come to the present. Libya now is a difficult place. It is broken into many pieces. I traveled to all kinds of places, but now I'm afraid to return to Libya. Getting into Tripoli airport is extraordinarily dangerous. The way to arrive at Tripoli now is to fly into Tunisia, into Tunis, and take an overnight bus to Tripoli. And along that road, you cross the border regions of Tunisia, where there are ISIS brigands who man checkpoints as you cross into Libya. That's Libya now. I'm going to talk a lot about Libya, so I want to give you a sense of these two eras, the one era of early Gaddafi and the era now of early regime change, and what this has meant for the people. So traveling in Libya now is, as I said, a very surreal experience because there are checkpoints across the countryside. Now, Libya is an interesting country because it's, to my mind, it's largely an archipelago of cities and towns. That, you know, there are, you enter a town and then you can drive into the desert and you come to another town. The checkpoints are all over the place and everyday life is perilous. Remember, the NATO charge to enter Libya was that they were going to enter to protect civilians. The outcome has been exactly the opposite. So I'm going to talk about the procedure known as responsibility to protect that provided the rationale for the war against Libya. But all along, as I'm talking about some of these things, I want you to remember that there are people who live there. That what happens in our various approaches in international law and discussions of diplomacy, when we talk about the Syrian war, we keep forgetting that there are really people that live there. That they have lives, they have families, they are raising children, they are worried about education, they are worried about food, they are worried about their culture, they are worried about their religion, they are worried about their lives. And I don't want you to forget that, because too often in these discussions we make everything arid and abstract. And places become just zones. They become war zones, they become geopolitical zones of discussion. So keep this in mind. Something dramatically changed in the early 1990s. When the United States started bombing Iraq in 1991, you know, after Iraq had entered Kuwait, inside Saddam's presidential palace, he had invited his closest advisors. And among his people who were there was his culture minister, Hamdan, who was a very erudite, well-read person. And in their discussions, which, by the way, like Richard Nixon, Saddam taped everything. So you can listen to these tapes and listen to the conversation. In that conversation, at one point, Hamdan is discussing with Saddam, where are the Russians? What is going on here? We are being pummeled. Baghdad is being bombed. Nobody is trying to stop this. In fact, if Hamdan had been slightly more cognizant of recent history, he might have noticed what had happened in Panama in 1989, and there's a great documentary called The Panama Deception, where the United States came with incredible force to basically bomb Panama City, send in special forces, seize Manuel Noriega, bring him to the United States and throw him in a prison in Florida. It's an extraordinary event. Unheard of event, really, if you think about it. I mean, yes, there's been in the 20th century a history of coups, history of overthrow, but most of them were deceptive. They attempted to say, we didn't have anything to do with it. Even the coup in Iran in 53, only later is the role of Kermit Roosevelt revealed. You know, American troops didn't come in there. Things were done in a kind of, as it were, cloak and dagger way. But in 89 in Panama, there was no debating what was happening. These are American planes bombing, American ships bombing. Fine, you could say, the harbor in Managua was mined, you know, to sort of suffocate the new regime in Nicaragua. But they didn't go in and bomb the country. They mined the harbor. That was an aggressive act. That was an act of war, but they didn't bomb the country. This was new. Massive bombardment of the country. Special forces comes in, seizes somebody, and is off. Wow. We haven't seen anything like that. Hamdan hadn't looked at Panama, maybe not taken Panama seriously. After all, to some people, Panama might have appeared always as an American colony. After all, the canal is there. America has some sort of extraterritorial claim, perhaps, on Panama. They might do this in a small Central American country. I mean, Contras, all this stuff was going on. Again, duplicitous wars, the dirty wars, there was no real direct American intervention. This was direct. So he's sitting in the presidential palace saying, what's happening? Where are the Russians? That's the moment when a new phase opens, which is the phase of unipolarity. Then the United States basically understood that constraints on its power had been removed. The Soviet Union had basically collapsed by then. You know, although effectively it's going to collapse later. Effectively it had already collapsed. In fact, by the late 1980s, its control over world affairs had deteriorated greatly. Some people say it had to do with Soviet intervention in Afghanistan. Also internally, economically, there were great troubles. And they were not able to handle their transition. They were gone. So Soviet bloc was not there to constrain American power. And the Third World bloc, as it were, had collapsed also in the 1980s. It was unable to put any challenge forward against Western power. And you might think, that's a silly thing to say. When were they ever able to challenge Western power? Well, you need to go back and see the fights in the United Nations General Assembly. If they didn't have the power to constrain, they at least used the institutions available to them to cry themselves hoarse about, you know, too much interventionism. I'm going to come back to the idea that suddenly with responsibility to protect, Westphalian ideas of sovereignty have been deteriorated. But I just want to say one thing directly, that for the colonized world, there was never a Westphalian protection of sovereignty. I mean, from, 1648 till, you know, R2P, which was passed in the UN in 2005, in the colonial world, there never was any integrity of sovereignty. I mean, you could come in anywhere. The French gunboat diplomacy, they want the Chinese to buy, to sell them tea. They basically throw opium at them. Chinese say, we don't want it. They go to war against the Chinese. Where is the question of Westphalia during the opium wars in China? So let's not see, when we think about sovereignty and we discuss, you know, Westphalia to responsibility to protect, we forget that large parts of the world never enjoyed the privileges of Westphalia. That was a privilege that the Europeans accorded only to themselves, not to the rest of the world. At any rate, with the Iraq opening here in 1991, what we see is a new era open up, this era of unipolarity where there is neither the Soviets nor the Third World bloc. And this goes from Iraq out to Yugoslavia in 1999. The NATO war on Yugoslavia. And the term of art used here was humanitarian interventionism. This was the term of art. In this decade, this term was understood by most people around the world as a so-called Western concept. In other words, It was a Western attempt to militarize human rights, to conduct these wars, to clean up the so-called rogue states. These were the terms that the US State Department and its intellectuals were mobilizing. Rogue states, humanitarian intervention, etc. The term rogue states was a very interesting term, because you then make a list of people who were outside the pale of civilization, that you could use whatever means to get rid of them. You know, and the list kept changing, but there were some actors who remained on it quite in a stable way. Iran, North Korea, Syria was on and off it, and then it remained on it, etc. These were the rogue states. Later, Venezuela will be seen as a rogue state. Not when the Christian Democrats are in power or Action Democratic. Those were not rogue. It was when Chavez comes to power, becomes a rogue state. So in the 90s, this concept of humanitarian interventionism was understood broadly to be a Western concept. And this is important for what comes next. It's a Western concept where human rights, the discourse of human rights, was being militarized. Now, in Darker Nations, I have a big section about how the concepts of human rights, the kind of contours of human rights, don't come to the United Nations from Western liberalism. They actually come to the United Nations from the anti-colonial movement. In fact, because many of the new states were not there at the table in San Francisco, it was a series of women from the Caribbean, from the Dominican Republic, etc., who sat there at the UN meetings in San Francisco and pushed hard for much more expansive ideas of human rights to enter the charter. This is a history we've broadly forgotten, that these women from the Caribbean fought to put human rights front and center. You know, there was no pressure coming from the Americans or the Soviets. Neither of them liked the concept human rights. You know, this was really an anti-colonial idea that comes on the table. But just put that on the side. But by the 1990s, the idea circulating in capitals around the world was that human rights was being militarized. In other words, it was interesting how certain people are beginning to define what constitutes a human rights violation and where. This was a very parochial exercise. So that I'm going to come back to this later. At no point, for instance, was the human rights of the Palestinians sufficient to militarize the response against those who are violating their rights. Or at no point was there an interest in the people in East Timor whose human rights were being violated. In other words, Western allies, when they violate human rights, however egregiously, don't come on the table as rogue states. And here, again, if you are interested in the story of Rwanda and the Congo, this is a very telling way in which that history must be understood. That countries that routinely have major violations of human rights but are Western allies will never have the question of human rights militarized against them. By the way, Exhibit A, Saudi Arabia. Just on the table, just for discussion. Okay. So, in this era, Western interests were masquerading as universal interests. So, humanitarian interventionism appeared as a universal logic, when actually, even in world capitals, people said, this is not a universal logic. In a way, the discourse of terrorism changes the shape of some of this argument. Especially after 9/11, there was now, because there was maybe global support for the United States at the time, there was a sensibility that interventionism was okay against terrorism. There were discussions now about anti-terrorist or counter-terrorist conventions where havens could be tackled even when they were outside in somebody else's sovereignty. So the discourse of the global war on terror opens the door for what had been, let's say, Western interests masquerading as universal interests, now becoming universal interests. But here, again, there is a great danger. So let's take three examples. United States goes to war in Afghanistan after 9/11, on October 7th, 2001, in order to clear out terrorist havens in Afghanistan. That was the premise. Later, because this has become a habit and militarization of human rights is important. Laura Bush, First Lady, says it's about women's rights. It's an irony. Remember I said earlier in the 1970s there were all these women in positions of authority, then you back this guy who hates women. Now you're saying we're going in to save the women. It's like a pinball machine, disoriented. You're being knocked here and there. You're not sure what to think. But they militarized human rights. In other words, you militarize women's rights here. To save women, we must go to war in Afghanistan. But the basic premise of it was that this is to knock out terrorist havens. Now, that's fine. Israel, you might remember, in 2002, decides to go and knock out terrorist havens in the West Bank, Gaza, etc., and starts major operations in the occupied territories. Now, I don't know if you remember a young American woman from Washington State, from Evergreen State College, Rachel Corey. A bunch of these Americans go in the International Solidarity Movement, ISM, to stand in front of bulldozers. And she is, of course, killed. Tom Hunsdale, a young British ISM person, is shot and killed. So these people went there because of this immense usage by the Sharon government, Ariel Sharon's government, to use the discourse of counterterrorism to clean up its problem. I mean, to define, in other words, Palestinian resistance as terrorism. So this was enabled. And again, backed by the West. The West, there was no complaint. You know, American citizen is killed. Her parents barely received a letter from the government saying that, you know, we're sorry that your daughter, a U.S. national, was killed by a Caterpillar bulldozer made by a company in Illinois, perhaps paid by the, I don't know, $3.1 billion disbursement per year that the Americans give to the Israeli government. So our taxpayers have killed your daughter. Sorry about that. There was no real acknowledgement. She was detritus. She had to be willed aside in this war against terrorism. So Israel used that. The Indian government was eager to also use this logic, especially after there was an attack on the Indian parliament on the 7th of December, 2001. What I'm trying to give you a picture of is that the logic of the global war on terror was appealing to lots of governments. They wanted to clean up their messes and disregard human rights. In fact, actually the opposite. Use the language of human rights to go and smash their enemies. Most effectively used in Sri Lanka by the government of Mahinda Rajapaksa to go and smash the Tamil Tigers, put people in concentration camps, etc. You know, very brutal end of that war. It was done in the name of human rights. It was done in the name of counter-terrorism. So the second phase after 9/11 is where militarization of human rights becomes a universal affair. Everybody's having a picnic here. They're all enjoying using this discourse to smash people. In this period, stunningly, the human rights community was quite asleep. I had a discussion once with people who worked at two of these groups in New York, and I asked them, you know, why aren't you writing a report on militarization of human rights? Not on this issue, that is, write a big report on the idea of the using human rights for conducting wars. A critical report. There was no stomach for that. In fact, you can see the level at which these groups stoop. Human Rights Watch, executive director of the Americas division, basically campaigned against the peace deal in Colombia. Basically, he campaigned against that deal. He wrote in the Miami Herald, he wrote in Colombian newspapers saying that you cannot have this deal because the FARC, the Revolutionary Armies of Colombia, cannot have impunity. They must face prosecution. What actually he's saying is the Sri Lankan solution, that the government of Colombia should go and use the discourse of human rights to crush them, kill thousands of people, rather than conduct a peace agreement and bring everybody to the table. By the way, just to put this in, again, another context, human rights organizations, Amnesty, HRW, nobody said at the time of the end of the apartheid regime in South Africa that there should be no impunity for the apartheid rulers. And they should be sent to prison and crushed. They said, no, no, peace and reconciliation, it's great. In other words, when the friends of the West lose, let's have peace and reconciliation. When the rogue elements lose, let's crush them brutally. Let's militarize human rights. Something to think about.
You're listening to Vijay Prashad on Responsibility to Protect, a new cover for Intervention. This is Alternative Radio, celebrating 30 years of independent broadcasting. You can order copies of today's program by calling 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or you can order online on our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org.
You see, George Bush ruined everything for this country. And I know this is an easy laugh, but I admire, unlike all of you, I admire George W. Bush. He's perhaps the most athletic world leader. How many world leaders would have ducked that shoot? Imagine, twice. Most of us would get smacked. If somebody threw a shoe at me, I would be struck. He was so quick. There's something to be said for being a former alcoholic. So your reflexes come back 10 times as good as those who have never had a drink before. Incredible. George W. Bush, not him, but his government, his regime, to use a term of art, his regime decided to go to war against Iraq finally, fully. After all, the United States had been at war against Iraq since 1990. That war had never ended. I mean, the sanctions regime was war by another name. You may remember, if you go and check on YouTube, you can see Ambassador Madeleine Albright being interviewed by I've forgotten, 60 Minutes. And she's asked about a UN report where I think Dennis Halliday was then the coordinator of Oil for Food. And this report, very, very powerful report, suggested that 500,000 Iraqi children had died because of the sanctions. And she's asked about this report, and Madeleine Albright, Secretary Albright, says, with a straight face and without contradicting or challenging the basis of the report, she said it was a price worth paying. 500,000 Iraqi children dead, a price worth paying. She could have said the report is biased. She could have said, I don't agree with the findings. Instead, she said it's a price worth paying. It's an incredible moral statement coming from the US ambassador to the UN, which is a post at the time. Incredible moral statement to have made. So the war had been unending. It had never really ended and then started again. But at any rate, in 2003, he decided to knock out the government in Iraq. I don't have time to get into this, but the strategic stupidity of this has baffles me. Like, what you do by knocking out the Taliban in Afghanistan and the Ba'ath in Iraq is you deliver Iran, for instance, a great gift. It's two neighboring enemies taken out by the Americans. In this book I wrote called The Death of a Nation, I said this American wars and Iranian victory. Because Iran now suddenly is able to breathe. It has a pro-Iranian government in Baghdad. It has its links to Syria. It has Hezbollah. It has this. It has that. And in Kabul, elements who had been in exile in Iran come to power, like Ismail Khan of Iraq comes to power in Kabul, very close to the Iranians. Incredibly bad decision, merely on regional strategic grounds. Forget the rest of it. But actually, let's talk about the rest of it. The United Nations Security Council refused to authorize that war, despite Colin Powell's scintillating PowerPoint presentation about mobile, you know, chemical weapon units. I don't know if you remember those pictures of the trucks, you know, like ice cream vans for chemical weapons. And you know, all this was quite extraordinary because as a young person in LA, Los Angeles, in 1988, I remember standing outside, on a traffic thing with a sign up against the Anfal campaign. And there was a company in LA that had sold, components for the mustard gas. So we went to picket it. There were about 6 Quakers, 2 Kurds, and 3 or 4 of us lefty lunatics standing there. Nobody cared about, the Anfal campaign or, Halabja. I mean, these words meant nothing to anybody. And by the way, at the time, Donald Rumsfeld was going, shaking hands with Saddam. Germans were providing equipment. Americans providing equipment. Go and tear gas the Iranians. Mustard gas the Iranians. To the credit of the Iranians, Ayatollah Khomeini at the time released a fatwa saying we will not respond with weapons of mass destruction. It's an interesting moment in Iranian-Iraqi relations, where the Iraqis were using mustard gas provided by the West, and the Iranians bizarrely said, we won't retaliate in kind. So you should go back and read this fatwa, especially around the question of Iran's nuclear policy. It's interesting to revisit that. But at the time, the UN said, no war in Iraq. Millions of people around the world protested, etc. UN said, not happening under our mandate. We are not giving you authorization. At that time, Kofi Annan, a year later actually, he should have said it right then, called this an illegal war. Now, what that war did was it delegitimized the universalizing of liberal humanitarianism. It made it illegitimate now to imagine that the West had universal interests. This was the death knell of liberal humanitarianism, and you can see this in the writings, the tortured writings of the former Canadian politician and Harvard professor Michael Ignatieff, who was deeply, you know, frustrated that the Iraq war had somehow ruined his life's work, which is to militarize human rights and to take out rogue states. Around this time, at the Brookings Institution, there was a South Sudanese intellectual by the name of Francis Deng. And I don't, many of you may have read his work, interesting work. Francis Deng wrote a book where he argued for the need for sovereignty not to be seen as an inviolable wall. That if a country does not protect its citizens, then the international community has an obligation to enter. And so he talked in his book about responsibilities, protection. He started using these words. Gareth Evans, who then would lead this charge intellectually and institutionally through the UN, adopts this language. And they, with the blessing, bizarrely, of Kofi Annan. You know, this is Kofi Annan, UN Secretary General, who had said that the war in Iraq is illegal and had criticized the use of human rights for war, now authorizes this responsibility and protection discourse inside the institutions of the UN, and they hold a big world summit where the UN says, fine, we accept that if a country is unable to protect its civilians, its sovereignty is not a barrier to intervention. That was the basis of responsibility to protect. Now, there are some immediate problems. Before I get to the problems with R2P, there are some immediate theoretical problems with the discussion in the first place. It assumes that the countries of the South anyway had full sovereignty. You know, this is in a time 20 years into IMF conditionalities, where most of these countries had surrendered their sovereignty to outside powers. Just take a silly example, Pakistan. Pakistan used to have quite a robust educational system. But after the 1970s, when IMF study teams used to show up, many of them, by the way, with Pakistani economists on board, they would come, and they did come, and they wrote their reports, staff reports, saying, you have to cut back on health and on education funding, privatize, in other words. So what happens is major funding enters from Saudi Arabia, Qatar, etc., to theologize education. This has an enormous impact on Pakistani society. So now how can you say that Pakistan is a sovereign country? Because its sovereignty has already been, you know, circumscribed by these IMF conditionalities, etc., etc., etc. So the premise of the discussion was itself poor, and sadly, in the debates, nobody raised this point. That let's look at the question of Westphalia, which I mentioned earlier, and colonialism. Let's look at the question of economic policy, which has already been, you know, eroded in our countries, and we don't have control over what's happening inside the country. So how can you now tell a government, protect your civilians? How, we cannot protect our people. We can't feed them. We can't educate them. We can't do anything. We don't have the resources. You have us on a leash, tight leash. So our ability to protect is already cut back. These are theoretical problems with the debate. But then there are practical problems that emerged in R2P itself. You see, the responsibility to protect was going to come under what is known as Chapter 7 of the UN mandate, which would allow use of force. Ultimately, there were different procedures, diplomatic pressure, etc., sanctions, but ultimately, it would allow use of force So if a country is unable to protect its civilians, its sovereignty is not a barrier for use of force to come in and protect civilians. That's what Chapter 7 of the UN mandate will allow. So very, very dangerous mandate to allow countries to use force against other countries legally. Now, why did I say they're practical problems? Here are at least four of them. The first problem is, who decides when the civilians are in threat? So, the parallel will always be for me, Palestine. When does the international community say, enough people are being killed, now we need a no-fly zone? Gaza, 2014, no-fly zone. Who called for a no-fly zone under R2P? Nobody. There was no pin drop silence in the at the horseshoe table in Washington, in New York City, at the UN. Nobody said no-fly zone, nobody said sanctions, nobody said anything. In fact, quite the contrary, the United States resupplied Israel twice or three times during the Gaza conflict of 2015. What conflict? The bombing of Gaza in 2014. So who decides when civilians are in under threat? One. Secondly, what is your evidence that civilians are being killed or in threat? This is not an idle question. We'll come to this with Libya and you'll see what I mean. Number three, what is a proportionate response to what is happening on the ground? What is a proportionate response under the R2P mandate? Do you go to regime change? And number four, after you've followed through an R2P mandated intervention, there should be a after intervention investigation. This fourth one is very important. Why? Because you want to make sure you haven't violated the terms of the mandate. Keep this in mind. These are four practical problems for an R2P mandate. Let's go to Libya. Number one, who decides? I was stunned interviewing ambassadors who were at the horseshoe table in March 2011, how little they knew about Libya. They had no clue. And because the Libyan ambassador to the UN had defected to the rebel group, there was no Libyan ambassador to explain anything. That means Libya's seat at the UN was empty. This is important to think about. Who decides? Ban Ki-moon, UN Secretary General, in a press conference, was asked, how do you know that there are atrocities happening in Libya? Fine, people are being killed, but how do you know? And he said, we have been reading press reports. Very interesting. We have been reading press reports. Okay. The US State Department said, this is Derek Chollet, who was in the National Security Council during the Libya time. Derek Chollet said, we, the US, did not have a particularly good handle on what was going on inside Libya. That's a stunning statement from somebody in the National Security Council. We did not have a particularly good handle on what was going on inside Syria. David Kirkpatrick of the New York Times at this time wrote, the rebels feel no loyalty to the truth in shaping their propaganda, claiming non-existent battlefield victories, asserting they were still fighting in a city, etc. This was in the New York Times before the vote for UN Resolution 1973. So the State Department says, we don't know what's going on there, and yet they are convinced it's genocide. What were they listening to? Well, the main news outlet that said that 10,000 people had already been killed in a matter of 10 days was Al Arabiya, which is the state outlet of Saudi Arabia. Now, I asked two of the important ambassadors who voted, one abstained and one voted yes, why did you take one news outlet seriously? And that to a news outlet that had, whose government had a vested interest in the overthrow of this person. And they said simply, there was no other information coming to us. I was actually quite horrified, to be honest with you. I've been around in this business a long time. I've talked to lots of people who have mendacious things to say. I was quite horrified by the innocent naivety that they proposed to reporters. You know, whether inside their heads they had other thoughts, I don't know. I'm just saying, their statements seemed innocently naive. But, you know, that's all we could see. So who decides is number one. And who decides, obviously, here was the French, the Americans, and Saudis and Qataris. Now, Saudis and Qataris said that they had the Arab League backing. Again, the media, which is to explain things to people, neglected to say that half of the Arab League members didn't come to the meeting. So Algeria, well, Libya, of course, didn't. Syria had been thrown out of the Arab League. Iraq didn't come. These were the main countries that would have opposed. They didn't come. It was basically the GCC countries, the Gulf Arab states, Saudi Arabia, Jordan, Morocco. You get the picture. These are all monarchies. So the Arab League claimed that they also wanted to go in and protect civilians seems to be somewhat spurious. It's not clear when you say Arab League who you mean, because Arab League is an organization split into two parts. One part votes for something, one part votes for something. Gaddafi, 2 years before his overthrow, had the indecency to come to a Arab League meeting, which was held in Qatar, where he, in his typically flamboyantly indecent way, turned to the King of Saudi Arabia and said, "You are a creation of the British." And then he turns to the Emir of Qatar, his host, and says, "And you are a dog of the Americans." So in international affairs, don't underestimate the important power of personal hatred, particularly when you're dealing with monarchs, because they have sort of absolute power. So the great hatred of Gaddafi in these capitals should not be underestimated. You'd think that sophisticated ambassadors and their departments of diplomacy would be factoring this into their calculations. And if Arabia is saying they're killing people, got to go and overthrow Gaddafi, you'd think, well, wait a minute, they hate Gaddafi. They not have to like Gaddafi. This is not a question of hate and like Gaddafi. They hate Gaddafi, they want to overthrow. Is this the best policy? Remember, I'm not interested in whether you like or don't like. What's the best policy? So one, who decides? Who decides was the West, Saudis, etc. Secondly, what evidence? We've already gone into that a little bit. Press reports, Al Arabiya, etc. Now the third part is interesting. Proportional response. So immediately that call was made, R2P must lead to protect civilians in Benghazi, because Gaddafi's forces were moving on them. And actually, Gaddafi's forces were not making enormous gains, but they were certainly moving. And Gaddafi and his son did themselves no favor by coming on TV and saying, "We will crush you all." By the way, if anybody understands the discourse of leadership in this tradition of republicanism, that's how people talk. You know, "We're going to crush you all like cockroaches. We're going to take care of you. We're going to destroy all of you. We're going to raise your houses." You should listen to Sisi talking about the Islamists in Egypt. You should listen to his Sisi speeches. "We're going to destroy your life." It's the same language. But this, of course, comes in the New York Times. He said he's going to crush them. Well, that's exactly the rhetorical gestures that these folks make when they talk. When leaders like Gaddafi, that's how they speak. So when the West decides protecting civilians is best done by regime change, and the fierce bombing begins of Tripoli, Amr Moussa, head of the Arab League, rushes to call a press conference in Cairo and says that we didn't want to back this. We just wanted protection of civilians. This is not what we wanted. Ban Ki-moon immediately grabs a hold of him. They have a joint press conference. Amr Moussa says, "Actually, no, no, we are on board. We are on board." Who decides what evidence, proportionate response? Not clear that regime change is exactly what R2P was designed to do, but it has become that. Now, investigation after the fact. Government is overthrown. UN resolution 1973 backs it. French and Americans provide most of the firepower. Qataris provide some bombing. Saudis provide some assistance. And there are these rebel groups. NATO is asked, because it was done by NATO formally, to allow for an investigation. And I want to read you what the NATO legal advisor Peter Olson said about this request for an investigation. He said, "We would be concerned if NATO incidents," he puts it in quotes, "were included in the Commission's report as on par with those which the Commission may ultimately conclude did violate or constitute crimes. We note in this regard that the Commission's mandate is to discuss the facts and circumstances of violations of law and crimes perpetuated. We would accordingly request that in the event the Commission elects to include a discussion of NATO actions in Libya, its report clearly state that NATO did not deliberately target civilians and did not commit war crimes in Libya. So after action analysis is allowed, but you have to give us before that a statement that we didn't do anything wrong. So what kind of investigation will this be? NATO eventually didn't turn over targeting information, didn't turn over anything, and the UN investigation, if you can read it, if you can tolerate it, these are things I spend my time reading, is dull as dishwater. Because it's basically them trying to write a report with no evidence. And they look at two specific, Human Rights Watch, that was a good report they did, looked at two specific bombing incidents and said civilians were killed. And they asked, why weren't these areas targeted? In other words, they would have needed targeting information and cooperation of NATO. So NATO refused to cooperate with a UN and with a human rights investigation to basically verify if the mandate was upheld. Was there an alternative to the regime change strategy that has destroyed countries and created chaos? It is important to remember that the African Union had wanted to insert itself in the early months of 2011 to mediate inside the complexity of the Libyan civil war, before the French bombers began to destroy the state. The African Union was set aside. When Saddam Hussein was arrested in Tikrit, he said, I am Saddam Hussein, president of Iraq, and I want to negotiate. The US troops humiliated him and threw him in prison, where he underwent a farcical trial and was executed. No doubt, Saddam was responsible for all manner of atrocities, most notably the use of Western-supplied chemical weapons against the Kurdish people of Halabja in 1988. But that moment was essential for Iraq. I want to negotiate. Negotiations are the antidote to regime change. Saddam Hussein might have been able to bring his Fedayeen Saddam to the table, asking for a truce and a new dispensation to save Iraq from destruction. Was he a credible force? Not for all of Iraq, but certainly for parts of it. In 2011, a NATO missile hit Gaddafi's convoy as it left Sirte. The Misrata militia seized Gaddafi, humiliated him as well, and then lynched him. He too should have been allowed to surrender and then to bring his political bloc to the table. In fact, in the early days of the Libyan revolt, Gaddafi sent emissaries, such as the retired US Rear Admiral Charles Kubik and General Wesley Clark, to say that he wanted a deal. The African Union's delegation sat in an aircraft ready to broker a deal. It was sidelined. Brazil's president at the time, Lula da Silva, offered to go to Libya and mediate a deal, backed by the African Union, Latin American states, and even the Arab League. But the West seemed to want a war. In both cases, the West and its allies prosecuted what appeared for them to be a complete victory, which ends in complete disaster if other political blocs remain intact. There was no appetite for negotiations in Iraq, in Libya, or in Syria. It seemed acceptable to allow the old guard to return in Egypt and even in Tunisia. These countries had been made pliable by other means. It seemed even more acceptable to allow the monarchies complete freedom to crack down on their regimes. But the old Arab nationalists in Iraq, Libya, and Syria could have no quarter. Despite their own drift from their earlier commitments, these political forces had to be fully destroyed. The lessons of Iraq were not learned. They were repeated in Libya, and they fly like a famished vulture over Syria. These countries hang by a thread. Their people suffer painfully. They have been sacrificed to a theory that is arrogant and erroneous. It is a liberal religion that seeks to save the lower orders and make them darker reflections of a Western fantasy that no longer exists even in the West. That theory, regime change, deserves a place in the dustbin of history. Thanks a lot.
That was Vijay Prashad on Responsibility to Protect, a new cover for Intervention. He spoke at Penn State University in University Park, Pennsylvania. Vijay Prashad is professor of international studies at Trinity College in Hartford, Connecticut. He's the author of many books, including The Death of a Nation and the Future of the Arab Revolution. This program is produced by Alternative Radio, based in Boulder, Colorado, celebrating 30 years of independent broadcasting. We are supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature progressive voices rarely heard in the corporate-controlled media, such as Arundhati Roy, Tariq Ali, Noam Chomsky, Ralph Nader, Richard Wolff, Naomi Klein, Bill McKibben, and Chris Hedges. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. To place a credit card order for CDs, MP3s, or written transcripts of today's program, Vijay Prashad on Responsibility to Protect, a new cover for Intervention, call us at 1-800-444-1977. Again, that number is 1-800-444-1977. Or you can order on our website, alternativeradio.org. Special thanks to Tim Butler for technical assistance. The Kronos Quartet performs our theme music. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamian. Thank you for listening.